Welcome to the Classical Happy Hour. I'm your host, Martin Davids. This is the show where my guests and I talk about music while enjoying a tasty beverage. Then we try to play some music together. Today's guest is Liza Malamut. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So tell me a little bit about what you're doing for work these days.
What I'm doing for work? Well, I moved to Chicago to direct the Newbery Consort. We just had our first concert this October, and it went really well. I was really happy to play with people here, and it was really great. And aside from that, I'm teaching historical trombone at Indiana University, and I tour with my other group, in Cantare, and I still freelance throughout the country, and I think that covers it.
Cool. So how did you end up running the Newbery?
Ellen and David announced their retirement, and I applied for the position, although I applied sort of at the last minute. I had never imagined actually that I would leave Boston. I lived there for 15 years, it was such an exciting opportunity, and the Newbery Consort is such a storied ensemble. I thought I would give it a go, and here I am.
Cool. So historical trombones, is that like all these other period instruments that nobody grows up playing?
I did not grow up personally playing historical trombone. I did grow up playing the modern trombone, and I discovered the sackbut when I was a student at Eastman my junior year, and I played this old 70s Finca that was in the instrument rental office, and I don't know the last time it had been played, and I sounded terrible on it. A friend of mine hooked me up with Greg Ingalls, who was a sackbut player who lived in New York at the time, and he became my teacher, and it was super exciting to discover not just the sackbut itself, but all of the repertoire written for it that I had no idea existed before that point. It was like 200 years of repertoire that I had never heard of before.
So, I mean, you hear a lot of modern brass groups play like Gabrielli and stuff, but are you talking like before, pre-Gabrielli kind of?
I would say in addition to Gabrielli, because yeah, brass players love Gabrielli. But all of the other, you know, thousands and thousands of works, polyphonic works, instrumental works that were written at that time that as a sort of mainstream classical musician you don't really hear about. Like Greg introduced me to Dario Castello, for example, who writes super virtuosic works that include the trombone from the 17th century, which I had never heard of in my life. And all of a sudden there's an entire book of chamber music that specifies my instrument. And then, of course, just amazing polyphonic works by Lassus and who else? Talas. I don't know. I could sort of go on forever about all the different works that really weren't in the mainstream, at least of classical trombone playing in my education, that was just really exciting to discover.
So do modern trombone players like play along with choirs the way that sackbut players do? Like,
that's a really good question. I think yes and no. I mean, yes in that works like the Mozart Requiem, for example, are still performed with modern orchestras, and that is a kind of playing, cola parte playing, where you have the trombone doubling the voices. But that said, I think it's a different kind of playing. When we study historical trombone, whether you're playing an actual sackbut or you're studying the style of historical trombone playing, you're really studying the articulation and the phrasing and the text of the music, and that's what you want to be thinking about when you play. So that was not initially how I learned to play, and I don't know about how you learned to play violin, but for me it was mostly kind of what was on the page, and text wasn't part of that. It was here's the bar line, and here's articulation markings, and you know, sort of 1, 2, 3, 4. It's a complicated answer to a very simple question, but I think it is different, although it happens in different ways, if that makes sense.
So the way you approach playing vocal music with a more of an emphasis on imitating the text,
mm-hmm.
wasn't how you played the modern trombone as a student at Eastman originally.
It definitely wasn't the same. There's a little bit of, I think, a different approach. You know, at the time I wanted to be a symphonic trombone player. So, you know, I was practicing a lot of excerpts, orchestral excerpts. Although, interestingly, before that, when I was much younger, when I was in middle school and high school, I played a lot of jazz. And actually, playing jazz is much closer to playing historical trombone, playing early music, than I would say practicing to be an orchestral trombone playing is, because you have that same vocal phrasing, you have the same you know, varied articulation, and it's a much different way of thinking about the instrument and about the music.
Yeah, I definitely had the same kind of education where, you know, play in tune, play with a good tone quality, vibrate, and, you know, play either loud or soft, crescendo, diminuendo, all those things, but there was never, if the words are accented in this way, that's how you should play it. That didn't come till I picked up the Baroque violin.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in fairness to my modern trombone teachers, they did teach me subtlety of musicality, but it's just a different era and a different type of playing. So when I was playing modern trombone solos, a lot of that is sort of a romantic style of playing where you're very lyrical, or conversely, you're very sort of militaristic. There's a famous trombone concerto by Ferdinand David where it sort of alternates between this fanfare style playing and then very beautiful, romantic, lyrical playing. So it wasn't as if musicality and vocality wasn't there, but it was a different type of vocality. And the type of vocality that we do as historical performers of Renaissance and Baroque music is very, very different. And that I was not taught until Sackbut.
Although it sometimes seems like text isn't as important to the singers.
I'm not going to comment on that one.
Because, it's the same kind of thing. The singers come out of their modern school of singing, and I think not all of them fully adopt some of these ideas about text being more important than... I won't drag you there. That's what we aspire to. So, did you always want to be a musician when you grew up, or were there other things that you thought you might do?
I definitely did not always want to be a musician. My parents were both musicians. My mom is a flutist, and she taught flute and various other musical things at Georgian Court University. And my father, his day job was running the family business, which was HVAC, sheet metal. But he actually was an operatic baritone and a very, very good pianist. And my brother and I both were made to study music when we were growing up. We both started on the piano, and then he picked up drums and I picked up the trombone. But the trombone was where I really discovered a love for music that I abjectly denied out of rebellion toward my parents, until finally the writing was kind of on the wall by my senior year of high school, and kind of admitted to myself that I really like this. So I took some auditions, and here I am.
So you were thinking, I need to go to a good music school, not just any old university.
I don't necessarily think I was... That's a good question. I would have to sort of rewind and go through my thought processes back at the time. I knew I wanted to... There were specific teachers that I was interested in studying with. I was also only allowed to apply to schools within a 300-mile radius of my home in New Jersey. So there are certain places I couldn't go. But I really wanted to study with John Marcellus at Eastman. He's just such a profoundly amazing pedagogue. So I felt really lucky to be able to have done that, for sure.
And then you turned your back on him.
You know what? I visited him this past summer, and we played Sackbuts together. And he was so good at it. He's just one of these people that is, you know, he's about the music. That's that's the most important thing, and he loved it. It was super fun.
Cool. Yeah, I haven't seen many of my old teachers in a while. Okay, so are there any like historical periods or like historical nations that appeal to you more than others? Like, was the sackbut big everywhere, or was it mainly like Italy, or where was it cool?
Well, it was really cool in Italy, although it was pretty ubiquitous throughout continental Europe. It was, of course, a Western instrument, although its great-great-great-grandparent was probably from the Middle East. The sackbut is a bigger version of the trumpet, much as I hate to admit that. trombone actually means big trumpet in Italian. The 16th century
was... You just ruined it for so many people.
I know, I'm so sorry. I would say the sort of golden age for the trombone was 16th, early 17th century Italy. You first start hearing about double slide trombones the late 15th century. And then you start hearing a lot about them into the 16th century. And that's Italy and Germany became a really big center for trombone, especially in the 17th century. But they were in England, they were in the wind bands in the Low Countries. They were everywhere in Europe. And one of the reasons for that is because they were the only chromatic wind instrument that did not have keys or fixed pitches, or like the trumpet at that time, there were no valves, so they had the overtone series. But the trombone could spontaneously tune to any key and any temperament, any pitch. So it was a really desirable instrument. It was used as, as we mentioned before, a colla parte, a doubling instrument, but also it was used as a substitute instrument even if a singer wasn't there. Because the timbre was so similar to the voice, and then it could just slot in if needed. It was used as a continual instrument. It was used as a solo, a chamber music instrument. There's a lot of super interesting eyewitness accounts and of its many uses. Agazzari comes to mind, where he says the trombone is it can be used in all these different ways. And that was because the technology at that time was very, very new. Now we can do a lot more with a lot of different instruments. But the trombone, interestingly, is the least changed of all of the Western instruments. It has only gotten bigger. It has not changed the fundamental properties at all.
That's why your teacher could play it?
Yeah.
So you don't have that problem where people drill holes in, like in trumpets?
No one drills a hole in the trombone that I know of. We did add valves over time, but...
But they always had a slide on them.
Yeah, they always had a slide.
That probably eliminates a lot of problems.
Yes, for sure. Although sometimes it adds problems because you have to take the whole slide off to empty the water out of your horn until about the 19th century when the water key started existing.
Oh, so that brings up an interesting question. Like these reproduction ones, I assume you're not playing an instrument from back then.
I am not.
Because that would be kind of gross, maybe.
Yeah, definitely not enough of them survive, and they're all in museums.
But have you made any upgrades on them, like adding something like that to get the water out?
Mine does not have a water key, although some of them do. Like you'll see a lot of bass sackbut reproductions with water keys on the end because the slides are just so long because they didn't have the metal wrapping and the valves back then. So sometimes for just practicality, people put a water key on the end. As long as it doesn't affect the sound, and this is a little bit of a slippery slope argument because it's like, how many changes are you going to make before it's like, kind of past the point of no return. But in some instances, I've made some adjustments, like I have a nickel slide, which would not have been used back then. They would have had a pure brass slide, and the nickel just allows the stocking to move a little bit more smoothly. Although some of my colleagues do have brass slides, they also wouldn't have had soldering. So you would have been able to take apart the entire instrument. It would be put together with beeswax, and they could stick all the parts in like a bag and jump on a horse and kind of go wherever they wanted. My instrument is soldered, because that doesn't really affect the sound, or at least if it does, it's so incremental that you probably wouldn't know. And it's just easier, you know, today to be able to carry around a soldered instrument than an instrument put together with beeswax.
Does anybody do that anymore?
Some people do. Yeah, there are makers.
It's probably easier to get it on a plane if you take it all apart.
That's actually a really good point and a really good argument for continuing to do that.
Just throw it in the overhead, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, violinists, especially with our bows, you know, those period bows, a lot of them didn't have a screw to tighten the hair.
Mm-hmm.
So they had these clip-in frogs, and it clips into one position. So if the weather changed, horse hair is one of the most sensitive things to humidity.
Oh, wow.
I think they use it in hygrometer, whatever that thing's called that measures humidity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's super sensitive to it. And so you're always having to put in like a little strip of leather or something to adjust it. And the screw is just a lot nicer.
I can imagine.
And I can't imagine how that would affect the sound except for making it better.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and easier to deal with.
Why do you want to fight with your hair?
Yeah, exactly.
So what instruments do you play?
In addition to the trombone or
do you play anything else?
Trombones. I do play the piano for fun. I would never perform on the piano. If asked.
You can do like an encore?
No, that's probably not going to happen. I play in the privacy of my own home. I can, if asked, play the recorder and the crumb horn. If asked.
Crumb horn?
I have.
Do you have one?
I don't have a crumb horn, sadly. Someday I will have crumb horns. I love them.
I mean, everybody loves the crumb horn, at least for like 2 minutes.
They're so much fun.
Yeah, is there anything that can make me as giddy as hearing a crumb horn?
As hearing, well, maybe hearing a consort of crumb horns.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I get you a crumb horn, will you play it on a concert?
Maybe. I'll commit to a maybe, like an 80%.
Okay. So you also play a recorder. Do you own any of those?
I own recorders. I don't think that the recorders that I own are recorders that I would necessarily play in a concert. I am not a expert recorder player by any means, but I can double to the point where I can play like in a recorder concert. And that's something that actually my teacher, Greg, insisted that I learn, because that would have also been something that they would have done at the time, is, you know, nobody would have just played the trombone. They would have been able to double on other instruments as needed. And even today there are groups that do that, like PFRO, for example, is a group that the instrumentalists will double on recorder, trombone, crumb horns, various other things as needed. So I guess I'm a utility recorder player. I guess that's what I could be called.
Okay, so you're not busting out a solo?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, some of the like cornetto players are pretty decent.
Yeah, for sure.
And a lot of oboe, baroque oboe players are good on recorder too.
Yeah, they have the finger technique.
Yeah, you don't need that on the trombone.
No, nope.
So you said you're teaching at Indiana University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just started in a more permanent fashion this semester, although I was there for 2 semesters at varying points when one of my colleagues, Linda Pierce, she used to teach there. So I filled in for her for a couple semesters, and it's wonderful there. The students are super keen and really smart and all, very engaged. I feel really lucky. It's a really cool environment to learn, and
nice library too.
Great library. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I remember I used to just go in there and find one book and then you just see what was around it.
Oh my god, yeah. Actually, when I was in the library looking for that Costello that you sent, I found the shelf where the Costello was, and then surrounding it was like all this other amazing stuff, like Peake and Caprielli and all this other Italian instrumental music. And I was like, I just want to sit on the floor and just take everything out of the shelves and bring it all back with me and play all of it forever.
This is my shelf right here.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. All right. So this group Incantare, what's that? Tell me about that.
So Incantare is a group that I founded with some other sackbut and violin players who we actually met originally through my teacher and then through Julie Andrzejewski, who teaches violin at Case Western. And she and Greg held this big workshop where we all came and we played this huge Gabrielli for like 22 voices. And Ben David and Garrett and I, who play sackbuts together, met Alice Kulin Ellison, who played violin, and everything just kind of clicked, both musically and, you know, personality wise. It was, you know, it takes actually, there's an element of luck when you form a group. I think sometimes, like, there are groups that, you know, you have most of the elements, but there's, you know, maybe one thing is missing, or there's not that special sparkly something that holds it together. But this was such a great fit. And then eventually we added our two other core members, Naomi Gregory on organ and Cynthia Black on violin. And we play mostly 17th century, sometimes late 16th century music. And our interest is lesser known composers, either from communities maybe that were marginalized or simply forgotten about, or people that sort of don't fall under the, you know, the canon of composers that we know, even as early musicians. There's really familiar composers, and then there's people that have just kind of disappeared for whatever reason, and our mission is to bring those people back to life, really, through music.
So there's always that balance of, you know, doing the interesting things people don't know, and then getting people to come to a concert for something, you know, usually they want to know something that they're going to hear, have an idea of what it's going to be.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you know, it's funny because at least with Incantare, that's not something we ever really talked about. I think we just kind of understood that there's music that we really, really like and music that we really want to play. And so we just decided to play it. We didn't really, there was never any conversation about like, how do we get people to hear this? We just wanted to play it because we think it's beautiful. We think it's good. And so far we've been pretty successful. You know, we're a small group and we do, you know, probably between 3 and 5 concerts per year, depending on the year. Of course, the pandemic upended everything. So now I have no idea like what our average concert year is, but, so far, that method has been successful.
I think it's a better way to look at it than trying to pander to what people do.
You know, sure.
If you've got a group that you think is just the group itself is something cool, and you're only playing music that you're into, that you really like, it's going to come across better than trying to force yourself to do things you don't want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of people that are doing like Bach. You know, who, and Bach is wonderful. They should be doing Bach, but you know, there aren't a lot of people doing like Hammerschmidt or like Muzio Ephrem. You know, you don't hear that anywhere, and it's just stunningly beautiful music. So, and it's fun to play. We love playing it.
Yeah, you know, the period after Monteverdi, but before 1700. Hardly anyone plays that stuff, which is really weird, like Lorenzi and people like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you look at, my wife did a dissertation on a Lorenzi thing, Magnificat by Lorenzi that she put in a modern edition. And she went and looked at like choral conferences and the music that was performed at them, and there was literally nothing after Monteverdi and before 1700.
Yeah.
Like nothing. The entire period was like as if it didn't exist, and they were still writing good music.
Yeah, they sure were. Absolutely. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time kind of wondering why that is. And I think partially it's familiarity. Partially, you know, the cynical part of me wants to say that, you know, we want to get people in the seats, so here's a familiar piece that we know people will like. And, you know, I'm not going to disparage that. I think that's a valid reason to play music. There are so many reasons why that could be, but I'm nevertheless still bewildered because it is just great music. There's so much great music, and it deserves to be played.
Yeah, and I'd always rather see a concert of people that really like what they're playing.
Yeah, totally.
Even if it's Bach. Actually, I enjoyed some Bach yesterday.
I really enjoy playing Bach, especially the ones with trombones.
Yeah, well, there aren't that many, are there?
There are more than you might think. I think, I'm going to try not to get into the weeds here, but a lot of times, sometimes I think they're performed without the trombones for whatever reason. So here's hoping for more Bach with the trombones.
Okay, you heard it. All right, so do you have anything, any advice for people, like young musicians? Or have you had any new insights into life that you want to share?
Oh, goodness.
You don't have to say yes to that last one. You got to answer one of those questions.
Oh, that's a high-pressure question. Advice for musicians. There's so many directions that could go in. But I think I think what comes to mind really is what we were just talking about is, you know, music can be... Having a music career, everybody knows it can be tough, right? It's not always an easy path to follow, but having specific things that you love to do that, you know, make it all worthwhile, like playing music you love, programming music you love, playing music with great colleagues and friends and... I guess my advice is to continually seek out those opportunities, whether it's a piece of music you've never heard of or going into the library and finding something new that's exciting. Or, when I was in school, like, if you're in school, if anyone's listening to this and they're younger, that's like one of the greatest opportunities you'll ever have to make as many kinds of music with as many different kinds of people and people with different interests than you will ever have in your life. So just take advantage of that and enjoy it. And sometimes it leads to really, really unexpected things. I think does that answer your question?
That works for me.
All right.
So just try as many things as you can. I mean, that's how a lot of us fell into early music, is just by trying it out and being like, wow, this is great.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
What was I doing before? Okay, anything cool coming up? I mean, I'm just going to throw in a little plug here for a concert we have together in December on the 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at Trinity United Methodist Church in Wilmette, Illinois. It's the Calipigian Players doing our Calipigian Christmas concert. It's free, and it's in the Home Alone Church. So, I mean, how can it get? It's like 2 days before Christmas. We got violins. We got a sackbut. We got an organ. It's going to be great. But before that, you've got a concert with your group, right?
Yeah, well, Newbury Concert is doing the annual Mexican Christmas show. I think it's December 9th through 11th weekend, and Ellen Hargis is actually coming back to guest direct that, so I will be playing sackbut and enjoying the music in that concert. And it's always really popular. It's a great show. And then Incantare is doing two concerts with Alchemy Viols in Indianapolis, I guess Zionsville specifically, as well as in Louisville, and we're doing German Christmas music. So those are the two forthcoming things for me. And then I'm very excited, actually, my students are playing the Schütz Christmas Story at IU. So anyone who's in Bloomington should also come see that. That's December 2nd and 3rd.
Okay, you can catch Liza all over Indiana and then also in Chicago in December. Is there anything you want to ask me?
Oh my gosh, I have so many questions for you. and of course, it's like when you go into a bookstore and you know that there's like a bunch of books you want to read, and then you go into the bookstore and they're like all in front of you, and then you don't remember like one book that you want to read, and you just kind of like look helplessly around the shelves. I do have some questions for you. I guess one thing that I would love to know, I mean, we never met until I came here, but you're like kind of everywhere, actually. So I'm really curious how you sort of got into the scene here in the Midwest, and like maybe this is too long a question for the end of a podcast, but like what your path was in historical violin here and how you got here.
Well, I went to IU. I got a master's at Michigan, and then while I was there, I started playing baroque violin in the early music ensemble with Ed Parmentier, and I thought, this is great, but I don't really know what I'm doing. And there weren't a lot of programs at that point, so Stanley was at IU, so I went down there and auditioned, and I was going to get a doctorate. And anyway, I ended up with a performer diploma,
mm-hmm,
because I wanted to finish.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, people were like 8 years in and still,
yeah,
not done. So, I wanted to have an adult part of my life,
mm-hmm,
out of school. And then I got married and actually moved to Canada. But then after a couple of years, my wife went back to school at Northwestern to get her doctorate in choral conducting. So we moved here. And I just decided, okay, I'm going to start a group, just find the best people in town and get them to play with me. And, you know, slowly built up all these contacts all over the country that I still play with a lot of.
That's awesome. So it seems like a really similar path in a way, where you sort of discovered the music, that you were doing something else, and then a door kind of opened for you and you went through it.
Yeah, I didn't have a plan. I just went with, I mean, you can't be that concerned with your future if you're just going to get a degree in baroque violin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair.
I just believed it would work out.
Yeah.
And so far, so good.
Yeah, awesome.
All right, so we're going to play a little something in a minute after we take a little break. I want to thank everyone for listening. Please subscribe to the show and give us great ratings. You can keep buying my CDs and other sheet music at bachfor2.com. And we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Thank you.